for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome to the Tom Hartman radio program, broadcast live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming all across the United States and Canada, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, podcast, Apple iTunes. Welcome back to our program, to the first hour of our three-hour program. Welcome to it, I should say, here on this beautiful Tuesday. Our quote for the day from Teddy Roosevelt, no less than Teddy Roosevelt, May 17, 1918. Teddy Roosevelt: the president is merely the most important among a large number of public servants. He should be supported or opposed exactly to the degree which is warranted by his good conduct or bad conduct, his efficacy or inefficiency in rendering loyal, able, and disinterested service to the nation as a whole. Therefore, it is absolutely necessary that there should be full liberty to tell the truth about his acts, and this means that it is exactly necessary to blame him when he does wrong as to praise him when he does right. Any other attitude in an American citizen is both base and servile. Teddy Roosevelt said, to announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public. Yes, it is more important to tell the truth about the president, pleasant or unpleasant, than about anyone else. Teddy Roosevelt, published in the Kansas City Star, May 7th, 1918. Speaking of the truth about the president, did he lie us into a war? Evan Syett is with us. Evan is a writer, speaker, and pundit in Los Angeles, former communications director for Los Angeles for George W. Bush. And Evan is with us to share I suppose you could say this is our...
Behind Enemy Lines.
Behind Enemy Lines segment, yes. What's going on here behind enemy lines? Evan, the right-wing talking points for the day on Joe Wilson.
I love the way you set me up. I've got right-wing talking points, so therefore anything I have to say you've already devalued because I'm just a shill, a puppet vomiting out whatever it is somebody else tells me.
Aren't I brilliant, Evan?
So right away the spin that you're conning your audience with is just unfair. You know, I mean,
Give us something that's not the talking points. Because I can read the talking points to you from the RNC if you'd like.
I'm expecting to hear something different from you. So the talking points might just be, hey, the truth. And that's why independent people such as myself would come to similar conclusions. For example, the idea that Karl Rove, who is not the target of this grand jury investigation, who didn't leak anything, because you can't leak the name of a CIA employee. You can leak the name of an undercover operative.
Well, hang on just a second here. We're concatenating things, and I'll let you interrupt me when I concatenate things or two, okay? We'll just have that as a ground rule.
Sure.
First of all, you say Karl Rove is not the target of a grand jury investigation. Grand juries have targets, which are the people that they are impaneled in the first place to prosecute, and there was no target to this grand jury. They didn't know what they were going to find. Then they have subjects, and the subjects are people who may become targets, and then they have witnesses. And Karl Rove is no longer in the category of witness, so I think we can safely assume he is a subject, which means he may become a target.
Well, he may become one, and I may become one, and you may become one.
No, it's pretty unlikely you or I will.
But where we stand right now is that, look, there is a law. The law is that you cannot intentionally leak the name of an actively undercover agent who is actively being protected by the CIA. Valerie Plame was not actively an agent, and she was not actively being protected, and we don't even know, for example, who was Judith Miller protecting. Obviously, it's not Karl Rove, because Karl Rove, being above board, signed a document saying anybody who wants to put out there anything I said to them is free to do so.
So it might have been Scooter
Miller. Judith Miller is protecting. You know what? That's not how we started this conversation. We're talking about Karl Rove.
Okay.
You know, you want Karl Rove to go to jail, and Joe Wilson wants him to be frog marched out of the White House. And the bottom line is we have another non-scandal that the Democrats have to pump up into the Holocaust, because otherwise people will say, hey, what are the Democrats' policies?
So, Evan Syett, the former spokesperson for the Bush campaign in Los Angeles.
No. Let's be clear, because that's very easily misconstrued. It was an organization that was not affiliated specifically.
I thought I was reading from your biography.
You are, but that's the name of the organization. It wasn't for the Bush-Cheney 04, which is what it would say otherwise.
Oh, I see. L.A. for President Bush is the name of the organization.
Okay. Correct.
And let me talk. Give you an opportunity here to talk. Toss out your website. It's Syet Wright. S-A-Y-E-T.
Yeah, you know what?
Am I mispronouncing your name?
Yes, it's the easiest name in the world. Even though we're such good friends and we've known each other forever, I've never corrected you before because, you know, you scare me.
It's Syet.
But it's Syet, yeah. Just the easiest name in the world. Just Syet.
So it's sayitright.blogspot.com.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I hope you will always correct me, Evan, when I get things wrong. Okay, sayitright.blogspot.com, your website. And by the way, if you have a question for Evan or you want to take him on, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, toll-free across the United States. I'm sure that Evan would be pleased to talk with you. Now, we were talking about Karl Rove and Joe Wilson, and you started out by saying that he wasn't a subject of the investigation. Then you went on to say that Karl Rove hadn't leaked anything. You have a very strange definition of the word leak. I thought that leak was revealing to the press or revealing to somebody else something which had previously been a secret.
That's correct, and it certainly was not a secret. There were lots of people who knew who Valerie Plame was.
Name one.
Somebody who did, her neighbors. Go check out the Washington Times, and they will list several of her neighbors who specifically knew exactly where she worked. And she made no bones about it. She hopped in her sexy little look-at-me Jaguar, drove every day to Langley, picked up the telephone, said, this is Ms. Plame. She didn't say it's Ms. Wilson, whatever. I mean, there was nobody.
Now, I've seen two of her neighbors interviewed on national television, Evan, and one of them actually is her lawyer, lives next door. The other was the person who lives on the other side next door, and both said, you know, we go to church with her. We see her every weekend. She works in the garden. We never had any idea. And that when people asked her what she did, she said that she was a consultant.
At the CIA.
No, she said that she was a consultant, period.
Go to the Washington Times, and again, I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage only because I can't call things up instantly and whatnot. The Washington Times has an article where they interview her neighbors. Now, obviously, people have lots of neighbors, lots of friends. There are some people that I tell that I'm a stand-up comedian in addition to everything else, and there are some I don't. But the reality is, even if you didn't know, even if her neighbor didn't know where she worked, it is no more of a crime or a leak than if her neighbor didn't know she worked at the 7-Eleven, and I said to her, do you know that Valerie works at the 7-Eleven? It is not the law, the letter of the law, and the intent of the law were both designed to protect undercover agents actively in the field who have been in active in Europe in the last five, or I'm sorry, not Europe, foreign nations, over the last within the last 5 years.
She was still operating this company, Brewster Jennings, and when this company got outed, our agents all over the world were put at risk, were they not?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, the only place I've ever heard that was from the Daily Kos.
I heard it from Joe Wilson on this program.
So you heard it from Joe Wilson?
Well, you're quoting Reverend Moon.
You're quoting Joe Wilson. Joe Wilson made so many contradictory statements, and then was
no. You guys are taking pieces of what he says out of context and twisting them around.
No, what he did was in his book he said something absolutely contradictory to the articles he's written, where there was nobody taking anything out of context, nobody questioning him, nobody. He wrote these things, and yeah, he was debunked by the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee.
No, actually, he wasn't debunked by the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee. What they concluded was that Dick Cheney did not ask Joe Wilson specifically to go to Africa, and in fact, Joe Wilson never said that Dick Cheney asked him to. What Wilson said was Dick Cheney asked the CIA to send somebody to Africa. The CIA called him in.
You're leaving out the fact that Joe Wilson said his wife had nothing to do with his being sent there.
No, Joe Wilson said his wife...
And they found a memo from the wife. Look, you can disagree with me, but that's what the Senate committee concluded.
No, first of all, what you're quoting, there was an addenda to the Senate committee written by three Republicans that none of the Democrats on the thing and most of the Republicans on the committee would not sign on to that made some of these very partisan charges, number one. And that's what you're quoting. And so it's not what the Senate committee concluded. It's what three Republicans on the Senate committee concluded. Well, enough said. Evan, our lines are filling up here. If people want to talk to you, let's take a few phone calls, okay?
Got it.
Our number 1-866-889-8894. Dan in San Diego on the line. Hey, Dan.
Wow. Hi. Well, I don't know why you let these Nazi thugs even on your show to air their lies.
Because number one, I can refute their lies, whereas when they go on programs like Crossfire or Tucker Carlson or whatever,
that's
nobody's
true,
there to refute it. And number two,
I want to
model for people a way to respond to them.
Okay, but anyway,
you can refute my lies, but you won't stop him from calling me a Nazi. You know,
guess what? You are a Nazi thug, along with all your ilk. You guys are all trying to kill Americans by the millions.
Yeah,
My question is, why?
Evan, calm down for a minute.
You guys get away with outing somebody. Karl Rove should be held to the highest ethical standards.
Absolutely, he should.
You are splitting hairs.
You're just as bad as Clinton with his blowjob in the office.
Yeah, Dan, you make a really good point. And let me just, Evan, let me just ask you very simply, you know, without. With all hyperbole aside,
mm-hmm.
was it really worth impeaching Bill Clinton for having sex with Monica Lewinsky and lying about it?
Not only was it not, but I vociferously fought against it.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll just put that one behind us then. Pat, although your conservative buddies can't say the same. Pat, New Mexico, question for Evan. We're talking to Evan Sayet. S-A-Y-E-T.
See, by the way, this is one of the problems, and I imagine this is not an atypical listener of yours, but I am a Nazi who wants to murder all our people because I won't agree to frog march a man who hasn't been charged with anything.
Well, I suspect that Dan's concerns were a little larger than that. The reality is that George W. Bush is changing, for example, the standards for clean air in the United States that is leading to the death of many Americans. He is changing the standards for manufacturing and workplace safety that are killing Americans.
Even that doesn't make somebody a Nazi. And by the way, our troops that are in Guantanamo Bay aren't Nazis. And the people who were murdered on 9/11, as Ward Churchill calls them, aren't little Eichmanns. And what it is, it's the on the side of the left.
Evan, I don't think anybody is suggesting that. I really don't. I mean, you're tossing. I am not Ward Churchill, and Ward Churchill does not speak for the left. You're tossing up a straw man, Evan. You can stop it right now. I mean, let's say I just mentioned Dick Durbin.
I just mentioned how many other people, and you're going to take on one of them who actually did say that and tell me I'm building a straw man while your guys call me a Nazi? Yeah, we're building a straw man.
Okay. Pat in New Mexico on the line. Pat, you're live with Evan Sayet. Say it.
Hi, I would just like to make the point on a small scale. I'm a truck driver. Whatever happens around my vehicle is my responsibility. If something happens under the law, it's my fault. With President Bush being in the position he's in, he's ultimately responsible. He is the one that's in position. For him to claim that he doesn't know what's going on, it's small-minded of people. It's his responsibility to know.
Good point, Pat. Thank you very much, Evan. We'll get back to the conversation after this break. We're talking with Evan Sayet. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Shake it up. Yeah, shaking it up here. One of my missions here, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense in the radical middle. I think all of us have conservatives in our lives, parents, friends, brothers-in-law, relatives, nephews, neighbors, and, you know, okay, people we work with, we interact with at work, and occasionally you get into a political discussion with them, and I think it's really useful to, number one, know how to have the discussion, to understand what their talking points are going to be and how you can appropriately rebut them, number one. And number two, how, at the end of the day, you're still their brother-in-law. You know, you can keep some semblance of a rational discussion and a relationship intact when all is said and done. And in that context, we've got Evan Sayet with us. Evan is a stand-up comedian and a political commentator out of Los Angeles. Evan, you're doing a fundraiser?
I am. I'm doing a fundraiser for the Freedom Alliance Scholarship Fund, which is provides college scholarships to the children of troops who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's August 17th at the world-famous Friars Club in Los Angeles.
Okay, great. August 17th at the Friars.
I'll put up a notice on my blog, and they can also just Google the Friars Club and give them a call. It's just a $10 minimum donation. You can give more. And it's a night of a whole bunch of conservative comedians.
Okay, and it's Say It Right, sayetright.blogspot.com, right?
That's it, yeah.
Okay, thanks. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. We've been talking about Joe Wilson. Perhaps in the next half hour we can get into the war in Iraq, and you can tell us all why that's such a great idea. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland on the line. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Great.
Hey, I just got to put this to you. Your guest here. I'm an independent myself. Just start off by saying I'll make my statement. I'll take my answer offline.
Okay.
He's unbelievable. First of all, you can't spend it. First of all, you got 70% of Republicans out here saying that they need a fire call role. The CIA is pushing for this investigation. If they didn't believe that she was not a covert agent or nothing like that, they wouldn't even be pushing the investigation. They should know the law better than anybody else. On top of that, since you think you got so much of the answers and you know it all, who forced the documents about the yellow cake that
yeah.
Joe Wilson discredited?
Okay, good points, Kenny. Evan, this investigation, this special prosecutor, was appointed at the request of the Central Intelligence Agency. They're the ones who initiated the request for an investigation.
And what you're
saying, it wasn't a CIA agent who was outed, she wasn't undercover?
Wait, that's not fair. You ask a question and answer it. Let me answer it. All right, the CIA is professional, long-term, lifelong people who are involved there. They're not the Bush administration, therefore the Bush administration is doing this, and therefore that's proof. You have some people within the CIA who really don't like the fact that George Bush is reorganizing, just like they don't like the State Department.
I'd say he's not reorganizing. I'd say he's purging. Anybody in the CIA who stands up and speaks out against his policies gets the boot.
That's just not true.
Well, look at all those people who resigned right after he got rid of Tenet.
Yeah, and a lot of people resign because how many people resign when you get rid of the boss that brought you in? I mean, that's what you do. The fact that people left, there has been, that I'm aware of, mass attack on George Bush from these retired CIA people. That's a natural time when people
retire. I had Ray McGovern on this program. He's the veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. There's a group of them, and they're all retired CIA agents, and they're all saying George Bush is committing treason to our country.
And there's a group of 9/11 families, a group of what, 5, 10, 12 out of 1,000, out of what?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the way that Bush engineered the 9/11 compensation, if you wanted to get that up to $1 million for your family, you had to sign a paper saying you wouldn't criticize the Bush administration's handling of 9/11. And so all the people who took the money signed the paper and they can't speak out. So you've only got a couple of dozen people who didn't take the money. They're the ones who are speaking out.
You need to produce that document.
This is no secret, Evan.
It's no secret,
theory.
It's a secret to me. So you're leaking it to me right now because I didn't know.
Well, I learned it in the New York Times. I'm sorry.
All right. So if you would, I told you I'm going to get you some backup to what I claimed earlier. Would you look for that document for me?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to do that. Okay.
So we just have a few seconds
before we have to take a break. We got about 5 seconds here. Your final response to Jay.
You know what? He made another point that I wanted to jump on, and I'm just not capable of handling more than one talking point at a time.
Okay, you need to get a pen and a piece of paper during the break then, Evan, so that you can handle it.
I got it. I wrote it.
All right. We'll be back. We got a bunch of people who want to talk to you. We're talking with Evan Sayet, sayetright.blogspot.com, his website. Evan, presenting for us the right-wing talking points, taking your calls. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
More united we stand, divided we fall. And if our back should ever be against the wall, we'll be together.
And And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 27 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, we're talking with Evan Sayet, S-A-Y-E-T, right, sayetright.blogspot.com. And Evan, the folks in our chat room went and checked out your blog, and a quote from, I believe it's July 17th, from Evan Sayet, "Democrats are racists. In fact, they are in many ways as racist as the Ku Klux Klan and even the Nazis." Democrats are Nazis?
No. I didn't say they were Nazis. What I said was they are racist, comparable in ways to the Nazis. And then I went on to actually back it up. I didn't just call them Nazis. And the point that I made was when a guy can get a job because he has 1/16th of his blood is supposedly Indian. Now, of course, he lied about it. But when a guy is considered something, do we know anything about a man because he's got 1/16th of himself is Indian? Do we know that he's a bad man?
Isn't that the criteria by the Bureau of Indian Affairs?
It doesn't matter what it is. It's a racist. A racist conception. When affirmative action.
So wait a second. Hang on. Just a second. I know you're talking about Ward Churchill, but here's the point. You don't think that what we did to Native Americans was racist?
First of all, that's what's called the red herring. We're not talking about
to why we had to figure out. I mean, because we murdered so many of them, and we stole their land and we raped their women.
And they were of course completely innocent.
So it's,
everybody.
Well, I don't recall the Europeans getting an invitation from them.
From who got an invitation for anybody to move anywhere? The fact that there were these huge tracts of land and they wanted to say you can't step on any of it, and we said how about if we share, and we went to war. And look, obviously what we did was wrong and bad, but was it this idea of the perfectly good versus the perfectly evil, the way that Democrats draw everything?
You're suggesting that any attempt to create to clean up the consequences of past racist actions are in and of themselves racist and shouldn't be done.
And anything that that seeks to divide people up and define a human being by nothing other than their race is by definition racist. The idea that a black man can get affirmative action whether he's
no, it's not.
Michael
racist
Jordan,
is when you harm people by virtue of their
no,
race, not when
racist.
You divide them by
that's,
virtue
no, no,
of
no,
their
that's
race.
The, that's the invention.
What is racist is what, is what Jeb Bush and Kathleen Harris did down in Florida when they defined black people you've got the same name as a felon in Texas, so you can't vote in this election and not 60,000 African Americans.
So many times, and yet the leftists keep playing the race card.
I'm sorry, it not only has not been debunked, the NAACP is still pursuing a lawsuit on it.
I know, and the NAACP is the one who Julian Bonds took the stage and said that anybody who doesn't agree with us is a member of the Taliban with Nazi swastikas hanging in their garages. The NAACP
Julian Bonds did not say
money.
That. Come on, Evan. Come on. Give me a break. You know that Julian Bond didn't say that.
Absolutely, Julian Bond.
Everybody who disagrees with him.
Julian Bond called
He said that everybody who disagrees with him.
Just like your caller called me a Nazi. Just like...
Just like you just called... Just like you said Democrats are racist, just like Nazis.
Hold on. I said that, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That there's a comparison. I did.
Okay,
but then I laid out examples.
Okay, I think we got it. We got your point. We got my point. At a certain point, we devolve into so much minutia that it doesn't really go anywhere.
Nazis put Jews into ovens because they had 1/16th or 1/32nd Jew blood in them. It was a decision based completely not on what the guy believed. He could even be a Christian. He could be an anti-Semite. They still shoved him into the oven.
That was clearly racist. That was not an affirmative action program, Evan.
Racism is...
You're trying to reinvent affirmative action as racism. You
racism
and Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown...
Of course it's racism. It's defining what...
No, racism is when people are harmed.
I don't care what the motive is. It's defining a human being as being nothing other than the color of his skin.
No, nobody is saying that people are nothing other than the color. Come on, you're engaging in wild hyperbole here.
Okay.
I think we've gone through this one. We've got to call it. I want to go back to the phone lines here. We've got to, all the lines are slammed up. Ken in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. You're live with Evan Sayet.
Yeah, Tom, I want to go back to an issue, a quick comment about the Valerie Plame situation. The problem was that it was supposed to be whether somebody leaked information, whether somebody
talk to the press. Now, even if her neighbors knew, I mean, it's not illegal to know somebody was a CIA agent, but what was illegal, and the problem with the Bush administration is that somebody in their administration leaked it to the press. Her neighbors weren't talking, but somebody from the Bush White House was. And
now,
that's
question,
the problem.
The question is, was it a secret that was being guarded by the CIA in order to protect an active agent?
And according to the CIA, the answer is yes.
And according to the CIA, there was enough information to ask for an investigation.
And
the investigation has not been
completed. Because according to the CIA, the answer is yes.
No, it's not. You find me the CIA. You mean you can find somebody within the CIA? Somebody who is a career person who is not happy with George Bush who said this, like Valerie Plame?
Well, like perhaps. George Tenet asking for an investigation, sure.
Okay, he asked for an investigation.
Yeah, well, he asked for an investigation into the outing of an undercover CIA agent. Do you think he was talking about Ralph Jones? He was talking about Valerie Plame.
No, he was asking for an investigation to see if a crime has been committed, who committed the crime, and we have an investigative arm that has not come out and reported anything yet. Now, Not only do you want Karl Rove, you know who his name is, and you want him fired, you want Bush done, there's no answer to this question yet, because the answer doesn't matter to the Democrats. You guys hate Karl Rove, and you want him frog marched out of the White House before an investigation.
So you're going to change the subject to, you're going to use the old canard, the phrase from the great right-wing spinmeister, it's all about Democratic hate, right? It's all about liberal hate.
Oh, it's exactly what I've been telling you all along. It's the fact that the Democrats recognize that they cannot put forth policy that the American people will ever elect them with.
You mean
the
like
American
Social
people,
Security, like good jobs, like
no,
minimum
like,
wage, like unionization, like clean air, like good forests? No,
yeah,
none of the Democratic policies Americans are in favor of.
If you want to frame it that way, that Republicans like clean air, and Republicans are from Mars and breathe through their neck and they want to pollute the whole world.
Well,
then,
the fact of the matter is, the Republicans have increased.
Then you can sell that issue.
George Bush is promoting this thing he calls the Clean Air Clear Skies Initiative, which actually increases the amount of pollution in the air.
We both want the same things. It's a matter of the difference.
No, I'm sorry. The Republicans want more corporate profit. The Democrats want more public good. There is a very clear difference.
The Democrats want to destroy corporations because they're evil.
No, not true. The Democrats want to stop the evil behavior of corporations that are behaving in an evil fashion.
Yes, evil fashion such as creating every medicine on this planet that I believe it's 90% of the medicines that are created on this planet are created by evil Americans.
And if you're going to save a dollar a vial when you're manufacturing that medicine by emitting toxic stuff into the local stream and killing people, sure, yeah, I think
so
that
toxic,
they should be regulated.
So toxic that they're killing people. Where are people dying? Nobody's falling over.
Tell that to the people in Bhopal, India.
Life expectancy is higher than it's ever been. Where is this killing people that these Nazi Republicans all want to do because the farmer in Kansas gives a damn if Halliburton makes another
dollar? Evan, one in three Americans in their lifetime will now get cancer.
Yes, and
when a baby is born, 270 chemicals, 175 of them known to cause cancer, are in their umbilical blood.
And
the reason
why
is because Republicans have fought so hard to protect corporations that are polluting and allow them to continue polluting.
This all just happened in the last 3 years. And by the way, they instantly, the minute Bush...
As a matter of fact, childhood cancer rates have doubled in the last 25 years, yes.
Oh, the last 25 years. And who was president for the last decade before Bush? Oh, but we don't talk about that. There's just this magical thing that Bush did is he pulled a light switch and dumped all these chemicals, and suddenly babies have things they didn't have 7 years ago.
Evan, I'm not defending Bill Clinton's international trade policies or his corporate policies. I think that the DLC Democrats are just as bad as the Republicans.
Okay, I'll take that.
Well, let's go back to the phone
lines.
That's
what you call progress.
Thurman in Omaha, Nebraska on the line. Hey, Thurman.
Hi. There are so many points I want to make.
Pick one, because we've just got another 10 minutes here, and I want to take a couple more calls.
Yeah.
In fact, I've got to stop arguing here.
Yeah, there's a misconception all about American Indian nations, and the whole blood quantum thing is a non-starter, because most of the American Indian nations, including the Cherokee, Choctaw, and everybody, were multi-ethnic, multinational, multi-ethnic nations that included blacks, Irish people, Scottish people, etc. It was a system of governance that was Native American. And so the whole blood quantum relating to ethnicity is a non-starter, because what it is compensation for taking the land of the nation, not
so. But why do you compensate people who may have nothing whatsoever to do with for example, let me flip it back to affirmative action, where somebody will get, okay, I can understand, hold on one second, I can understand,
okay,
you, they get compensation for slavery
and
whatnot.
It's war reparations, Evan.
But I understand that war reparations to the loser?
Yeah. Yeah, when you do an unfair war, when you use germ warfare, when you do genocide
warfare,
nobody
used germ warfare.
Oh, sure,
it's
we did. We invented it. We invented it. We had the cavalry use. We traded smallpox-infected blankets with Indians in Ohio and Michigan.
No, we didn't.
I'm sorry, Evan. This is part of American history. This is
It's part of leftist American history
in
the textbooks that the leftists write. But there's just nothing behind it. There's just nothing behind it.
Yeah.
It's the concept of anything that's America is evil, 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 and anything that we go up against is not. It's the idea that...
Evan, I'm sorry. That is a horrible, god-awful generalization. There is a lot about America that is absolutely wonderful and that I totally acknowledge. And the fact that we gave smallpox-infected blankets to Indians is a matter of American record. You'll find it on U.S. government websites. I wrote a book about this stuff. If you want to have an argument, that's not the one to pick, I'm telling you.
Were the American Indians a good number of the different tribes cannibals?
Not to the best of my knowledge, no.
Okay.
In Celebration. In fact, that was a myth that Columbus perpetrated about the folks in Hispaniola.
So Columbus is the liar, and the ones who
actually, according to his brother Bartholomew, he was. But again, okay. I'm telling you, you're going down a road you don't want to go down. Mike in Celebration, Florida, is on the line. Hey, Mike.
Hi, guys. Just a quick thing here on this Dick Durbin quote. I'm getting tired of people saying he was calling Americans Nazis and everything. He was reading. I listened to him on the floor, and he said he was reading from an FBI report.
No, he wasn't. Hold on a second. Let me just clear this up for a second. He was reading from a private memo supposedly from one FBI source. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, he was reading from a FBI source. And he said, if I didn't know any better, I'd think this was product of the Nazis and the gulags.
And let me ask you a question. Would you really think that if you received a memo from a Jew during the Holocaust and it said, man, they're really torturing us here, the air conditioning is off in the interrogation rooms?
So this was a guy who had been chained in the fetal position on the floor for 24 hours without food or water and had pulled all of his own hair
to
him.
That as well was debunked by a recent investigation, but of course the Democrats...
But Dick Durbin didn't... Whether or not that's been... whether it's been debunked or whether it's been whitewashed, we'll never know, actually, number one. And number two, Dick Durbin didn't know, and nobody knew at that point whether it was true or not, but he's saying, hey, this is stuff we need to look into. Mike, thanks. You made a good point there. I appreciate it. I want to move along from this, Evan.
That would be an absolutely reasonable thing for Dick Durbin to have said. This is unacceptable, and it's something we're going to look into. But it's not what Democrats do. They compare us to Nazis, and the guy on the telephone compared me to Nazis, and the Abu Ghraib is comparable to the...
Well, I have to say, Evan, that there are some really spooky parallels between the Nazis and what the Republicans are doing right now. The enabling acts that the Nazis passed right after the war allowed the Gestapo to open people's mail.
And Ronald Reagan was exactly as... And look at all the gas chambers we found when he was gone.
Well, we're now building a death camp in our concentration camp down in Guantanamo Bay. We just authorized the construction of a death camp down there.
Look how he didn't.
Scott in San Diego, California. You're on the line with Evan Sayet.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. Evan, I've got to say thank you for being on the air. It takes a lot of courage to go up against Tom's audience because there's a lot of smart people there.
Absolutely. Tom's a smart man himself.
He really is. I always learn a lot listening to his show. This issue with Roe is a lot deeper, and a whole bunch of people are really missing the point. And I got to agree with you, sir, and I normally wouldn't, but this is a very complex issue. I think it boils down to a couple things with Roe. Number one is he violating SF 312. He signed an agreement when he came in, classified information non-disclosure agreement.
Yes, this is the one that no conservatives want to discuss, by the way.
Well, yeah, because it goes right to the heart of the matter. If I know something, even if I don't know if it's declassified, I can't say anything. I was in the military myself. I can't say anything until I am certain the information I'm giving is not classified. I have to operate under the idea that It's classified information. Anything I know is classified. And I work this way. I work on IP and corporations where I am told when I go in, I sign a non-disclosure agreement, and I am told specifically, if you don't know, keep your mouth shut, because I can be taken to court because I work on intellectual property. Secondarily, this is a little more complicated than just that issue as well, because Karl Rove may not be the first one. It could even be, and no one's talking about this, Ari Fleischer.
Well, here's what I find interesting. So far, we've seen Karl Rove, who's the assistant to George Bush, and Scooter Libby, who's the assistant to Dick Cheney. Maybe it's Bush and Cheney who started this whole thing.
Hard to say, because there's a memo that came out the day after Ari Fleischer and the staff flew to Africa, the day after Joe Wilson's memo came out. That information about that the whole relationship was on the plane. Ari Fleischer had access to it. So did several others. And all the barriers of security break down when you are in close proximity to a lot of people. Ari could have read it and walked just a few steps away and said something about it.
Interesting point, Scott. Thank you for the call. We got to take a break here, Evan, okay. And I'll let you respond to this right after the break. But I'll let you think about this during the break, and you can come back with it. It seems to me like the conservatives are closing ranks here, and in a big way, in a surprisingly big way, and that makes me wonder if they're trying to protect George W. Bush and Dick Cheney rather than just Karl Rove. We'll get your take on that when we come back from this break. It's 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, exposing the con in conservative.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Over the mountain, down in the valley, lives a former talk show host.
Uh-oh. Hey, welcome back, my friends. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, high technology for low prices. Give them a call if you like the show. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS for all things Macintosh, all things computer. Any sort of computer needs, hardware, software, help. Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MACS, and, of course, smalldog.com, their website. And thanks to them for sponsoring the program. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, 1-866-889-8894. We're talking with Evan Sayet, S-A-Y-E-T, right.blogspot.com, his website. And, Evan, we only have about 2.5 minutes, and our phone lines are absolutely slammed, and so I'm going to ask you to keep your responses to just a sentence or so, and I'm going to ask my callers to make their points in just a second or so, and we'll see how many we can get here. Is that all right?
All right.
Okay, Susan, Santa Cruz, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom and Evan. Evan, I have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you want for this country and for yourself?
Oh, obviously what I want for this country for myself is I want, first of all, to be safe. I want more even than for myself, for my children, to be healthy. I want the opportunities for myself and more so for my children to accomplish as much as their energy and ambition will allow them.
I think we all share those goals, and that's the marvelous thing. We share those goals, and yet we have different ways to achieve them. It's pretty remarkable. Chris in Raleigh, North Carolina, you're live.
Hey, very quickly, why was it that right before everybody knew it was Karl Rove who leaked Valerie Plame's name out there, it was a huge deal for everybody? Bush was calling for firings, but now as soon as they find out it's Karl Rove, it's like, huh, it's not a big deal. He didn't
do anything. A better question is, how come when they didn't know it was Karl Rove, every single media organization filed a legal brief, a friend of the brief court, saying that there was no crime committed, and as soon as it became possible that it was Karl Rove, suddenly you have the newspapers reporting and doing all the things.
That's an interesting news spin. Trisha in Sweet Idaho on the line. Trisha, you're live.
Hi, Tom. I have several points, and I'm going to try to be as quick as possible.
We have 15 seconds.
Oh, boy. Okay. First of all, I'm wondering why Karl Rove doesn't get treated like every other officer in our nation, where there's this kind of conflict of interest and investigation process, why he isn't suspended and put on a...
Because he's been charged with nothing. There's nothing there.
Well,
no, but
neither is an internal investigation. You know, many of the people that are average citizens that police and take care of our country... Wait a minute.
Yeah, I have to end it here. I'm sorry, but Trish, your point is well taken. If a police officer is accused of doing something inappropriate, even if there's no evidence, even if the investigation hasn't started, they're put on temporary leave with pay. Why not Karl Rove? Evan, we're out of time, but we'll have you back,
and
we can cover that. Say it right, sayetright.blogspot.com, Evan's website. Thanks, Evan, for being with us.
All right, Tom.
I do
you.
Appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space in the Sirius radio, satellite radio system, on WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org. iTunes, iPodding. Welcome back to our program, TomHartman.com, the website if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and say hi. 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free telephone number. Are we overworked or do we have overconsumption in the United States? Which is it? Have we gone over the edge in terms of the amount of work we're doing, or are we simply consuming so much, buying so much, thinking that we need so much that we're working ourselves to death and in order to be able to afford it? John DeGraff has some unique insights into this. John is the coordinator of the annual October 24th Take Back Your Time Day. He's the editor of Take Back Your Time, co-author of the best-selling book Affluenza, and the children's book David Brower, Friend of the Earth. Hey, John, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you. Good to be on your program.
Well, thank you. Glad to have you here. You say it's time to begin a new national dialogue. By the way, let me set this up. This is our Bioneers segment for the week, and I had neglected to mention that. Bioneers are scientists and artists, gardeners and economists, activists and public servants, architects and ecologists, farmers and journalists, priests and shamans, policymakers and citizens, everyday people committed to preserving and supporting the future of life on Earth, heralding a dawning age of restoration founded in natural principles of kinship, interdependence, cooperation, reciprocity, and community. How do we bring that about, and what does that have to do with work, John?
Well, I guess your first point, you're asking if we consume too much as a society or just work too much. And I think when we talk about American society as a whole, we are an over-consuming society, and we're working harder than ever in order to make that happen. If we talk about individual Americans, then there's a lot of difference, and there are many Americans who are working long, long hours, sometimes 2-3 jobs, just to make ends meet, because we have such a great gap in this country between rich and poor. With the Take Back Your Time movement, we're trying to address both of these kinds of time poverty, the time poverty of the affluent, which we think we can start to trade some of our consumption for more time. That is to trade our increases in productivity for time to live our lives instead of more money and stuff. And then at the bottom, though, we really still need to give people a living wage and other kinds of things so that they can make ends meet without working themselves to death.
But one of the problems whenever we talk about productivity is that the measure of productivity, broadly speaking, the way that productivity is measured in our economy is such that if a corporation sends part of its manufacturing overseas, they're making more stuff with a smaller number of labor dollars inside the United States, and they register it as an increase in productivity. A lot of the increases in productivity that we find in the federal measures of productivity, and particularly those reported in the Wall Street Journal, are actually the consequence of offshoring. And there's no possible way for us to recapture that in terms of our having more time, is there?
Well, I think a lot of the increases in productivity, we tend to look at it on an annual basis, and a lot of the increase in productivity has also come from working people longer hours within the United States. I actually think that that's where the biggest amount comes from. And if we look at our gains still in productivity. I think if you compare, for instance, the United States today with 1970, you don't see really any larger segment of the economy that's involved in global trade or globalization than you did then. I think there that we tend to hear all the stories about the stuff that's being outsourced, but we have a huge domestic economy as well.
But hang on just a second, John. You know, in the 1970s, you could take Amtrak down the Eastern Seaboard and you'd see thriving factories.
Mm-hmm.
You take that same Amtrak train today and all you see are empty boarded up buildings.
True.
I grew up in Michigan, and I can tell you, in Michigan there's a lot of places that in 1970 were thriving and today are gone, and it's the direct consequence, nothing more or less, pure and simple, the direct consequences of trade policies that were changed after 200 years of having essentially protectionist tariffs in the United States that were changed by Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr.
No question about that. I mean, I do think we have shipped out a lot of jobs, but I do recommend the work of Doug Henwood in the Left Business Review and analyzing some of this stuff in more depth. I think it's an issue that's sort of too complex to get into in detail in the time that we have, and so I guess I'd rather focus on some of what we can do in terms of public policy to give people more time in their lives.
Then what can we do?
Well, one of the things that we advocate with the Take Back Your Time movement is that we catch up with the rest of the industrial world, which also has issues involving outsourcing and globalization and so forth, that we catch up with them in basic things like, for instance, family leave. The United States is one of only five nations in the entire world that doesn't guarantee any kind of paid family leave for parents when a child is born. The only other four countries that don't are Burkina Faso, Lesotho, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea. Now, that's just an incredible thing that we don't understand, that parents need time to bond with young children, and they need some money to do that. Canada, our neighbor to the north, gives parents of children a year off at 55% of pay. This is common throughout the industrial world. Secondly, we're the only industrial country that does not have any guaranteed paid vacation time for its workers. In Europe, everybody gets at least 4 weeks after 1 year on the job. That's just a requirement to join the European Union. Thirdly, we're the only industrial country that does not guarantee any paid sick leave for our employees, and consequently, we have a lot of people working sick, bringing illnesses into the workplace, and adding to the cost of health care. Finally, I think we need rules that would limit the number of hours that people can be forced to work. Right now, in Europe, you can't make people work more than 48 hours in a week. U.S. has no such limits. And we need rules that would allow people to choose part-time work and still prorate their benefits and keep their hourly salaries and be able to work less if that's what they want to do. Other countries have these things. We can have them, too.
But at the same time, I don't disagree with you at all, John, on that. In fact, I applaud you for saying it. And if you look at Germany, for example, right now, Germany, it looks like the relatively moderate Christian Democrats are going to be, you know, pushed out. A more conservative leader is coming in. I'm forgetting this woman's name. And there has been this trend in Europe. I mean, you know, a lot of it tracks back to Margaret Thatcher, but a lot of it really just goes back to Clinton and WTO and GATT, and of becoming more like the United States. They call it neoliberalism, but you know, really what it is corporatism of signing into trade agreements that so-called level the playing field in ways that benefit multinational corporations but harm national governments. And so you've got this, you know, France is, you know, increasing the number of hours that people can legally work. Germany
is... Let's look at that. I mean, I think that that's the message that the American press would like to get out and have Americans believe. But I've talked to the people at the ILO in Geneva about this, and they say that if you look at Europe overall, there is no trend toward longer work hours. There are specific anecdotal incidents that have happened, particularly in Germany, in the difficulties.
But you've got an entire government in Germany about to change on these issues.
Not that much. They're not going to give up their long vacations. They're not going to. And in France, if we look at what's happened in France, people think that the 35-hour work week in France is akin to the 40-hour work week in the United States. It is not. It is a maximum work week. And the only change in the 35-hour work week now is that if employers and workers agree, workers are allowed to work an additional 4 hours overtime. That is up to 39 hours a week. That's a very different situation than what we have here.
But I got to say, John, I lived in Germany for a year. I read German, and I read German publications, and there is a steady drumbeat in the German media right now. And just, I mean, regularly stories about how if Germany doesn't become, quote, more competitive, end quote, become less labor friendly, if they don't start changing their policies and changing their rules, they will not be able to compete with the Eastern European country, the former Soviet bloc states that are entering into the European Union. And you know, they're having terrible problems with unemployment right now. And they think that the solution is to become more like the United States. And they are moving in that direction.
This is true, and I'm still saying that Germany is something of a special case in this regard. If we look at, for instance, the situation in, if we look, for instance, at the new countries coming into the European Union, all of those countries will be required to now follow EU law, which requires 4 weeks vacation, which requires the 48-hour limit.
But it doesn't set pay standards, and so you've got somebody in Romania who can make $4 an hour, and you got somebody in Germany who's making $25 an hour, and now what's going to happen is the Romanian's going to go up to $6 an hour, and the person in Germany is going to go down to $10 an hour to, you know, so that the corporations can say, okay, we're not going to move our factory out of Germany. I mean, look at all the industry that Germany, France, even the UK have lost in the last 15 years as the result of just the beginning openings of the EU.
Actually, I suggest reading the article by Thomas Gagan in a recent issue of The Nation, which actually looks at those things and says, hey, the manufacturing loss is not very much at all if you actually consider the
number.
Shouldn't
there be manufacturing increases?
Well, I don't know. I mean, again, this is
we're buying more manufactured goods.
I mean, I appreciate what you're talking about, and I don't disagree with you either. But this is a very big and complicated issue. And my sense is that Germany, it's a tough case. And
well,
German wages have been very, very high. There's no question about it.
And we only have about 2.5 minutes left here, and I don't want to get lost in minutiae here. The point that I was asking is that if we see the rest of the world trying to go in a more conservative direction, in a more business-friendly, worker-hostile direction, and you're suggesting that here in America we should be making changes that are more worker-friendly and that what business considers hostile, and the reality is that they do, even though we know that it might be the best thing for business, how do we accomplish that in that kind of an environment?
Well, I think we just have to organize. I think people really want these things, and I think that they can have these things. And I think if we keep pushing the idea that everybody else is losing them, which is certainly not totally true by a long shot. For instance, if we look at England, the British just doubled their length of paid family leave. The Canadians just doubled their total of paid family leave to a year. The Swedes and the Danes just added 1 week's additional vacation time. The European Union just adopted European Union-wide the Dutch policy for part-time parity that allows people to choose part-time work and keep their benefits and prorate their salary or keep their salary their hourly salary. And it's these messages that need to get out that this is doable.
So how do we get these messages out?
Well, that's what we're trying to do.
Stuff in the Wall Street Journal.
Oh no. Well, that's what we're trying to do with the National Take Back Your Time campaign. We suggest that people check out timeday.org. There are, I think, other places where that's beginning to happen. We're having our national conference in Seattle at the beginning of August. We'd certainly invite you to come up and cover it.
Well, thank you.
A lot of these conversations, we help people be coming from Europe, from the International Labor Organization, and making many of these kinds of points. But we can't push this issue forward, and I appreciate your having me on, because we can't begin to push this forward until we start to talk about it. And I think progressives have to talk about the issue of time for people. Both pollsters, Frank Luntz, Bush's pollster, and Celinda Lake, the Democratic pollster, now find that lack of free time is the number one issue that for Americans, and yet we are not addressing these issues.
Yeah, and to our detriment, both
physically,
spiritually, psychologically, emotionally.
Yeah, we have the worst health in the industrial world because of not only because of our health care, but also because we're working ourselves to death.
Yeah, well said. John Vandegraaff, our pioneer of the day, his website, timeday.org, right? Any
yeah,
else?
Yeah, it's just John DeGraff, actually. No Van.
No, oh, I'm sorry. John DeGraff, you're right. And I'm thinking of good old Mr. The guy who invented the generator.
The generator, yeah.
Okay, John DeGraff.
Hope to talk to you more at some time. Tom.
Thanks, John.
Thank
good
you.
On you. Good. Keep up the good work. www.timeday.org. Check it out. Check it out. Show up for the conference. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Robin Bush and his merry band ripped apart this happy land. It's Robin Hood with a switch. He steals from the poor and gives to the rich.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Ellen.
How you doing? Well, it looks like it's Edith Clements, but I'm not 100% sure. Of course, the president is going to announce tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock your time. I don't know what the venue for that's going to be, whether it's going to be Oval Office, Open Press. That will be decided a bit later. But it does look like it's Edith Clement. And if you do a Google search on her, particularly if you also do a Google search on Edith Jones, who's the other rumored possibility, Edith Jones has a lot of sort of paper behind her. Edith Clement does not. And that looks like we are probably going to see Edith Clement, because they want somebody without a clear paper trail.
Yeah, I checked out Edith Jones, and she's basically one of the ones who are trying to reinvent American history, is saying that all the founders were super upright churchmen who thought that this nation should be run by the ministers, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, when in fact most of the founders were deists and were very skeptical about, I mean, they had just lived through the Puritan era. They had lived through the witches being burned in Boston, or hanged in Boston, burned in Salem. And they were very skeptical about religion being involved in government. So Edith Jones, apparently, a little more, she would satisfy the Tony Perkins crowd.
Well, she would definitely get the right happy. But, you know, he wants a nominee, and he wants one fast. And as they said at the White House this morning, the president has consulted with three-quarters, well, either the president or the president's chief of staff. I mean, I know that, for instance, Rove himself called several senators and spoke with them. And so that he said that they have called three-quarters of the Democratic senators. My guess is that they are not going to go with somebody who does have any kind of paper trail. Because if you have a paper trail, you know, people can make it front and center on every television program, and there go Bush's ratings.
How do you know if Karl Rove was calling a bunch of senators that he wasn't calling them to out another CIA agent?
Well, we don't. we certainly from the senators.
Yeah.
So we absolutely know that that has happened.
Okay. What else is going on in Washington, D.C.
today,
Ellen?
Well, I think the president refused to answer really any questions about when troops were going to be withdrawn when he met with the Prime Minister of Australia. Absolutely no discussion whatsoever. Just saying, you know, we will do it when the job is done. Again, his counsel for, his chair of the Council on Economic Advisors reiterated, the president's position that he's not going to sign Social Security, without these private savings accounts for younger people, which means that I think the Social Security legislation is going nowhere fast.
Right. And a good thing it is, frankly. I mean, if we're not going to have a crisis for 40 years, it's better to put this thing off for a few years until we get somebody rational in the White House than to wreck it precipitously. In my
right. The other thing that we're hearing is that somehow that the Prime Minister of India has really focused on meeting a lot with Republicans and not so many Democrats. sort of shutting them out. And a lot of people are saying this is not going to bode well when they need a treaty. This is not a very sensible thing. He doesn't have as huge an entourage walking with him. He just literally, I was coming down on the elevator in the Capitol, and he was, you know, 2 feet away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And very few people with him. Has a nice sort of motorcade, but not a whole lot of people with him at any one point.
What does that mean?
I mean, here's a guy that's prime. Well, nothing. It's except that you would expect. I mean, if this was the president of the United States, his security detail and everything would be like quadruple.
Yeah.
But this guy is, and this guy's president, the prime minister of a billion people.
Yeah, that is pretty remarkable when you think about it. Huh, interesting. Okay, Ellen Ratner, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Ellen.
You're welcome.
For the report today. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Hope you have a great one, and we'll be able to figure out who Edith Clemens is. That should be fascinating. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, tomhartmann.com. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS. I'm Tom Hartmann.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
They say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartmann here with you 27 minutes before the hour. If somebody committed a crime, they will no longer work in my administration, says George W. Bush. Yeah, another 13 words. Another 13 words. Unfortunately, it's not what he's been saying for the last 2 years. For example, on June 20th, 2004... This Bob Furtick over at Democrats.com, he says, mark your calendar. Yesterday, July 18th, the beginning of the end of the Bush administration, points out, on June 20th, 2004, question at a news conference, do you stand by your pledge to fire anyone found to have leaked Valerie Plame's name? The president, yes. Everyone knows this. All the bloggers know it. Everybody in the press knows it. No matter how many right-wingers you get on, like Evan that we had in the first hour of our program, trying to re-spin it, trying to recalibrate it, everybody knows it. And Bush has flip-flopped. Now, you know, this, what really got me, the word flip-flop is one that has been really, really well impregnated, interpenetrated with meaning, with very specific meaning, as a result of Karl Rove and Frank Luntz's efforts in the last election campaign, applying it mercilessly to John Kerry in ways that really had nothing to do with flip-flops. And in fact, you know, as the regular listeners of this program know, George Bush flip-flopped on far more issues than John Kerry did, and did so in far more radical fashion. Yet the Democrats never tried to apply that word to Bush, which always mystified me. Why didn't they do that? And here they have an opportunity. Why aren't they doing it? Why did I not hear yesterday? I heard Democrat after Democrat after Democrat on TV and radio programs talking about how George Bush had changed the game. He'd changed the goalposts. He'd moved it to a different stadium. He'd all these metaphors, all these sports metaphors. Nobody said he'd flip-flopped. Sounds to me like a flip-flop. George W. Bush, flip-flopper extraordinaire. First, I was against the leaking, but that was before I was for it. And as Bob Furtick says, this is no ordinary flip-flop because he did it right in the face of the entire press corps, right in front of the entire world. So Furtick christens it the flip-flop-a-looza. Flip-flop-a. Yes. What's this going to do to George W. Bush's credibility? Well, we'll see. How many members, by the way, one of the pressing questions of our day, How many members of the Bush administration are needed to replace a light bulb? How many Bushies does it take to change a light bulb? The answer? 10. 10! One to deny that the light bulb needs to be changed. One to attack the patriotism of anyone who says the light bulb needs to be changed. One to blame Clinton for burning out the light bulb. One to tell the nations of the world that they're either for changing the light bulb or they're for darkness. One to give a billion-dollar no-bid contract to Halliburton for the new light bulb. One to arrange a photograph of Bush dressed as a janitor standing on a stepladder under a banner, light bulb change accomplished. One administration insider to resign and write a book documenting in detail how Bush was literally in the dark. Another to viciously smear the guy who wrote the book. One surrogate on to campaign on television at rallies on how George Bush has had a strong light bulb changing policy all along. And finally, one surrogate to campaign on TV and at rallies to confuse Americans about the difference between screwing in a light bulb and screwing the country. Takes 10. Yes, indeed. 10 to... Now, a slightly more serious vein. Yesterday, Eric Rudolph was sentenced. He's probably going to spend the rest of his life in prison for acts of domestic terrorism. Now, that's not the name of the crimes that he was charged with. He was charged with attempted murder and things like that. I think he should have been charged as a terrorist. He was a terrorist. And I think he should be called a terrorist. And I'm just astounded that if a guy with brown skin had come to the United States from another country and had set off a bomb at the Olympics that killed somebody, as Eric Rudolph did, he would have been called a terrorist. But when you get a white-skinned Christian American setting off a bomb at the World's Fair, he's not a terrorist, he's a bomber. And they call the BBC the word police? World's Fair or something? It's the Olympics. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Scott. Yeah, the Olympics. I appreciate that. Now, here's what's interesting. Eric Rudolph apparently got his information when he went off to bomb abortion clinics and to try and kill abortion doctors. Apparently got his information from a website run by Neil Horsley. Neil Horsley. Now, Neil Horsley was on the Alan Colmes show recently. And I just to put this in context. First of all, we have Rick Santorum. Senator Rick Santorum, the esteemed Republican senator from Pennsylvania, coming out and saying that if we allow gays in the United States to marry, then soon you will have people having sex with animals. That in his mind it was the same thing, qualitatively the same thing. And one would lead to the other. You had Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court saying that if the Texas sodomy law was overturned, you would have people having sex with animals. Well, I'm broadcasting here from Portland, Oregon, and just north of us in King County, Washington, this story, sheriff's detectives are investigating the owners of an Emmonclaw area farm, that's a little town up here, after a Seattle man died from injuries sustained while having sex with a horse boarded on the property. Investigators first learned of the farm after the man died at Emmonclaw Community Hospital. The county medical examiner's office ruled that the death was accidental and the result of having sex with a horse. A surveillance camera picked up the license plate of the car that dropped the man off at the hospital. This is from the Seattle Times, Jennifer Sullivan, staff reporter, which led detectives to the farm and other people involved. Other people involved? Well, it turns out that this farm was actually a house of ill repute. No, I'm not making this up. Deputies don't believe a crime occurred because bestiality is not illegal in Washington State and the horse was uninjured. However, they found chickens, goats, and sheep on the property, and they're looking into whether animal cruelty, which is a crime, was committed by other people having sex with these smaller, weaker animals. Turns out the farm was talked about in internet chat rooms as a destination for people looking to have sex with livestock. Urquhart, the sheriff's Sergeant John Urquhart said, quote, a significant number of people we believe have likely visited this farm, end quote. So now, is this going on because gays are getting married, as Rick Santorum and as the Supreme Court Justice Scalia said? Or is this going on because the anti-abortion forces, the guy who runs the website that was used apparently by Eric Rudolph to figure out where he should bomb, one of America's leading anti-abortionists, Neil Horsley, started the trend? I suspect it's the latter. I suspect it has more to do with that. For example, this is an Alan Colmes program.
You are known for your anti-abortion and anti-homosexual views.
Yes, it's our right-wing nut job special for the day.
With animals?
Oh, when you grow up on a farm in Georgia, your first girlfriend is a mule.
I'm not so sure that is so.
You didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia. Did you?
Are you suggesting that everybody who grows up on a farm in Georgia has a mule as a girlfriend?
I'm saying that it has historically been the case. You people are so far removed from the
reality.
Look,
I'll admit, Neil, I'm a city boy. I don't know a lot about growing up on a farm.
Well, welcome to domestic life on the farm.
But I think for you to say,
welcome to domestic.
There are a lot of people listening to me right, Neil. There are a lot of people listening to me right now who live on farms, are raising kids on farms, who grew up on farms, and I don't think they're dating Elsie right now. You know what I'm saying?
The fact of the matter is, don't know that, in fact, you experiment with anything that moves when you're growing up sexually, you're naive, and you know better than that. You know yourself. If it's warm and if it's damp and it vibrates, you might, in fact, have sex with it.
No, not me.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah,
no,
you know,
thanks.
Oh, come on. You know, I've had sex with anything that would move.
Right.
If we had a warm watermelon out in the field, I might give it a name.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
And he's running in the other direction, I'll tell you. So, this is what it's come to, the anti-abortion forces in America. That Neil Horsley, one of America's leading anti-abortion folks, telling us about the reality of American sexuality. Very strange. On the other hand, then, we have Congressman Tom Tancredo, who's actually been on this program before. Tom Tancredo asked, how do we respond to Muslim attacks? And see, this is, we're changing topics now. How do we, away from bestiality, how do you respond to an attack in the United States that is apparently perpetrated by Islamists when, in fact, it may not have anything to do with Islam? This is the discussion that Americans need to be having. This Robert Pape has written this brilliant book called Dying to Win, as I recall is the title of the book, in which he's talking about how when a country is occupied, you get suicide bombers in the Middle East. And they are not necessarily Muslim. In fact, four of the first five suicide bombers in Lebanon were Christians. When Israel first occupied Lebanon. When countries are occupied, you get suicide bombers. And the longer we occupy Iraq, the more suicide bombers there'll be. Pure and simple. It's got nothing to do with religion. It's got nothing to do with religion. If you want to start a religious war, you can start a religious war, but you're starting it from the wrong basis. The problem is the occupation, not the religion. Now, you and I understand that. Apparently, Tom Tancredo did not. He was on a radio program.
Tom Tancredo on WFAL in Orlando.
Worst case scenario, if they do have these nukes inside the borders and they were to use something like that, what would our response be?
What would be the response? You know, there are things that you could threaten to do before something like that happens, and then you may have to do afterwards that are quite draconian.
Such as?
Well, what if you said something like, if this happens in the United States, and we determine that it is the result of extremist fundamentalist Muslims, you could take out their holy sites.
You're talking about bombing Mecca.
Yeah. I mean, what if you said, that this is the, we recognize that this is the ultimate threat to the United States, therefore this is the ultimate threat, this is the ultimate response. I mean, I don't know, I'm just throwing out there some ideas, because it seems to me at that point in time, you would be talking about taking the most draconian measures you could possibly imagine. And because other than that, all you could do is, once again, tighten up internally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, this, the fundamental fallacy here, the belief that we are fighting against a religion, that just all of a sudden, after thousands of years, well, 1600, Islam has been around since what, the year 700, 600, something like that. So after 1400 years, all of a sudden, this religion starts changing and producing suicide bombers. No. It has to do with our occupying their territories. In the countries where American combat troops are stationed, you have suicide bombers. It just pretty much boils down to that, or people who are perceived as the surrogates of American combat troops. And Al-Qaeda is growing stronger and stronger from this, and it's not about religion. And then you have, you know, misinformed Congress. Now, to his credit, Tom Tancredo is now backing away from his statement, correcting it. But this is what this tells us is that the average, certainly the average Republican in this country, and frankly, I think probably most of the Democrats, are clueless when it comes to what's really going on in the Middle East, what kind of hornet's nest we have really stirred up, how with Bush's insane policies, with George W. Bush's policy of trying to get political capital, domestic political capital here in the United States, trying to take back the United States Senate in 2002 and trying to win election for himself in 2004 by making himself the war president and deciding that the war he's going to have, he wasn't going to have a small war like Reagan did in Grenada. He wasn't going to have a limited war like his father did by throwing the Iraqis out of Kuwait. No, he was going to have a big war. Because he wanted to be as big as Franklin Roosevelt, because he wanted to undo Franklin Roosevelt's policies. Keep in mind, that's what this is all about. This is all about undoing Franklin Roosevelt's policies.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And number one is to take down Social Security and replace it with programs administered by banks. In other words, privatize Social Security. And the first step to that, to introduce private accounts. And Bush felt that the only way that he could get the political capital to accomplish his goals and to get himself reelected and to secure a Republican majority in the House and the Senate was to be a wartime president. And now we're pushing on 1,800 American soldiers dead. We don't know how many independent contractors are dead. It's the second largest army in Iraq, and they're suffering a very high casualty rate. And 100,000 at least Iraqis dead so that George Bush could have political power. And then he lied about it, and Karl Rove's trying to protect him. We'll see where that goes. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring.
And welcome back, my friends. 55 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. What kind of country destroys the job market for its own citizens? Asked Paul Craig Roberts. Is there economic treason going on in the United States, as well as international espionage treason, while Karl Rove is outing CIA, undercover CIA agents? Is it possible that George W. Bush and his minions within the administration are trying to destroy the American middle class, hand our manufacturing and infrastructure over to China so that China can then threaten us with nuclear weapons? Paul Craig Roberts notes the June payroll jobs report did not receive much attention due to the July 4th holiday, but the depressing 21st century job performance of the U.S. economy continues unabated. He points out only 144,000 private sector jobs are created. Keep in mind, you have to create 150,000 a month just to stay at zero. That's how many more people are entering the workforce every month. Only 144,000 private sector jobs were created, each one of which was in domestic services. None of them manufacturing jobs. 56,000 jobs were created in professional and business services, about half of which are in administrative and waste services, 38,000 in education and health services, almost all of which are in health care and social assistance, 19,000 in leisure and hospitality, almost all of which were waitresses and bartenders. Membership associations and organizations created 10,000 jobs. Repair and maintenance created 4,000. Finance activities, 16,000. This, notes Roberts, is the labor profile of a third-world country, not a first-world country or a superpower. U.S. manufacturing, in fact, lost another 24,000 jobs. He points out that in Omaha, Nebraska, there's a software consulting company that's running a Help Wanted ad specifically saying that they want to hire people who have H-1B visas. Why? Because, A, people with H-1B visas are people who are not citizens of the United States, who are here legally and working, and they'll work for less pay than American citizens. He says, gentle reader, when you read allegations that there's a shortage of engineers in America necessitating the importation of foreigners, you're reading a bald-faced lie. I can tell you this. One of my nephews is an engineer. I'm telling you, the importation of H-1B visa holders and the exporting of jobs primarily to India is wiping out the market for engineers in this country. Thus, we're not educating them. Thus, we fall farther behind. It's a terrible, vicious spiral that we are falling into as the result of 25 years of failed conservative international trade policies. A disaster for America.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It looks like it may be Edith Brown Clement. We'll see. But this is, she seems to be the one that the pundits are suggesting, well, the New York Times and the Washington Post specifically, are suggesting will be George Bush's pick. We will find out tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Central, Pacific time, rather. But George Bush, just in time to pull Karl Rove's fat out of the fire, just in time to move Joe Wilson off the headlines, just in time to change the subject. As Bush said last night, I'd like to get this over with as quickly as possible. Well, here's how you do it. You announce a new Supreme Court candidate. If it is Edith Brown Clement, it's going to be a really, really interesting few days, let's say, or a few weeks, because Edith Brown Clement doesn't have much of a paper record. I've spent a fair amount of time here today Googling her. There's just nothing out there. She's a judge. She has been for apparently about the last 10 years on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the Louisiana court, the one based in New Orleans. She was formerly clerked for Judge Herbert W. Christenberry, who, as Scott tells us, was involved in the Clay Shaw decision. In fact, Scott, do you have that in front of you? Do you have that information? Okay, I got your mic hot.
Oh, yeah. I've got it here. Yeah, I'll go ahead and put it to the chat room.
Well, you can just tell us right now.
Well, basically it says right here that website that the Judge Herbert W. Christenberry dismissed perjury charges that Garrison filed against Clay Shaw following Shaw's acquittal. And, of course, this is related to the theory of the JFK assassination related to the movie,
right?
JFK.
Right. Yeah. So the guy that she worked for was involved. Yeah, that gets bizarre. Thanks, Scott. I appreciate that. Frankly, I don't think that has, you know, apropos to nothing. It's interesting. It's one of those interesting things. But I don't think that that's it. Anyhow, her confirmation battle, this is from freerepublic.com. Kay posted this. I'm not sure where it came from, frankly, so I can't attribute the source as far as I can tell. It was posted, by Ripper Snapper. Anyway, it's a pretty good biography of her, however. She was appointed in 2001, to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Prior to that, she clerked for Judge Herbert Christenberry. She was confirmed 99-0 in the United States Senate when she was appointed. She doesn't provide much ammunition for opposition groups, but not so much for conservatives to get excited about either. This is where it's going to be interesting. Frankly, I suspect that if it is Edith Brown Clement, a 57-year-old judge, with the potential to stay on the court for a good long time to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, if George Bush does appoint her, that he's going to have serious problems with his right wing because they're going to be afraid that she's going to pull a Souter. David Souter, you'll recall, was appointed by George Herbert Walker Bush. He was a lifelong Republican, probably still is, from New Hampshire, and just a classic kind of New England Yankee, you know, quiet, kept to himself, didn't have much to say to anybody, quiet Republican. And so Bush Sr. figured, hey, this will be a slam dunk. We'll get this guy in, and he'll do the agenda. Now, keep in mind, Bush Sr. supported Roe v. Wade until he became vice president and ran for president, until he had to pander to the right wing of his party. For that matter, Bush Jr. supported Roe v. Wade early in his career. So, you know, both Bushes have a history of having flip-flopped on this issue. One of the things that probably has also made the right wing so hysterical about this. You've got Reichers like Tony Perkins out there, just hysterical that Bush might appoint somebody who would uphold Roe v. Wade, as if that were the only case, you know, in the entire world to worry about. But they talk about some of the cases that she's decided. Tarver versus the City of Edna, for example. This with regard to civil rights and liberty. And liberties for a unanimous panel, she allowed a plaintiff who sued the police for violating his right to due process to proceed with his claim that the officers who arrested him used excessive force when they allegedly injured him by slamming the door of their car against his head. She reversed the district court's finding that the plaintiff could also sue for unlawful arrest and excessive force involving the use of handcuffs. So that, you know, sounds like it might have been a reasonable case. Environmental protection and property rights. She voted for the Fifth Circuit to rehear a decision blocking developers from building on a site, this again from the Free Republic site, from building on a site where six endangered bug species lived in a cluster of limestone caves. Here she joined a dissent that said that the Commerce Clause of the Constitution doesn't protect bugs. And this is the originalist argument. She's a member of the Federalist Society. This, you know, what's his name? Scalia has changed. He's come up with his new word. He calls it originalist, the originalist theories. And what it is dressing up what used to be called constructionist, and before that what used to be called states' rights, and what used to be called before that used to be called the pro-slavery faction of the Supreme Court, which is basically those who believe that number one, the Supreme Court's job when it comes to interpreting the constitutionality of laws should be done in the context of how the founders would have thought about it, which means that since the majority of the founders were in favor of slavery, we should still have slavery, at the very least segregation, et cetera. It said that if the majority of the founders were opposed to women voting, if the majority of the founders thought that women should not have property rights, that's simply how it should be. In other words, the originalists, the Scalia-Thomas faction of the court, and Judge Bork, of course, as well, had he gotten on the court, this is very much what they're all about. And they look at the Constitution, and they see it as a cast-in-stone document. Now, Thomas Jefferson made the interesting point that the Constitution was a living document and that it should change. And, in fact, both Hamilton and Adams made that argument in the Federalist Paper papers over and over and over again when they were selling the Constitution. They kept pointing out that there was a mechanism built into the Constitution by which it could be amended, because things change. If you can get two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate to vote to pass an amendment to the Constitution, and then you can get three-quarters of the states to ratify it, you can change the amendment. And it's been done. It's been done. It's not very rarely. There's been almost 20,000 amendments to the Constitution that have been offered up over the years. I mean, that's quite a few times that we've tried to amend the Constitution. But the total number of amendments that have actually passed is, as I recall, 27. The 27th Amendment passed in 1992, which adjusted congressional salaries. And it's pretty rare, 27 amendments out of 20,000 that have been proposed. But nonetheless, it's a mechanism for changing it. And Jefferson made the point that you wouldn't expect a man to wear the same clothes he wore as a child as an adult. And you wouldn't expect him to wear the same clothes as an older man as he wore as a younger man. In fact, Jefferson suggested that there should be some sort of an automatic mechanism wherein every generation, and he defined a generation as every 19 years, he was looking at demographic data back then, and he said at any given point in time, you know, the major focus of power will change every 19 years, basically every generation. And today we consider a generation to be about 20 years. So Jefferson, you know, not that much has changed, really. Infant mortality has changed significantly, but that's about it. And Jefferson suggesting that every 19 years the Constitution should be revisited, that the world belongs to the living, not the dead, he said. So anyhow, the originalists look at the Constitution and they say, well, the Constitution should just be interpreted the way that the founders said, and there should be nothing added to it, nothing taken from it, which, of course, as I said, would take us back to slavery, take us back to women having no rights, and that sort of thing. And obviously, although Scalia and Thomas would take us in that direction, I think, frankly, the other seven members of the court are a little more intelligent, shall we say. So, but she did take an originalist position in this environmental protection law, where she ruled that the environmental protection rules, the Endangered Species Act, the law that says that if there's a species which is in danger of vanishing from the web of life, if that's in danger, and somebody can make some money, and in the process of making some money, kill it off, she would side with the people making money rather than the species. And so this case, GDF Realty Investments versus Norton in 2004, she said that the decision's rationale for protecting the bugs to preserve the interdependent web of species bore no relationship to Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. See, the Constitution does say, it's called the Commerce Clause, says that the federal government has the right to stick its nose into commerce between the various states. They can't do it within a state, according to the Commerce Clause, but they can do it between the states. And in fact, that fairly broad power was ultimately what Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson had to use to desegregate the South, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. They went in and because in the South you had these strict constructionists, these originalists, these jurists on the Supreme Court in the mold of Thomas and Scalia, who said, hey, the Constitution doesn't say anything about integration. It doesn't say that you have to allow black children into the University of Alabama or into the public schools. And in fact, in Dred Scott, Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896 or 1898, the Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, you can have separate but equal schools. John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the clerk of the court, wrote an eloquent headnote for that case in which he suggested that it would be absurd to think that the founders imagined that the races should be mixed together, as Bancroft Davis said, John Chandler Bancroft Davis. And so, you know, the originalists on the court in the 1960s, the strict constructionists were saying, we're not going to be judicial activists and say that the founders would have wanted there to be integration in the United States. And, you know, she's apparently doing something very similar to that by saying, you know, well, we're not going to be an activist here. and say that, with the Interstate Commerce Clause, my point of the Commerce Clause was so Bobby Kennedy, what he had to do was he had to go in and say, okay, this has to do with commerce. And this was the first, you know, they busted up the school, the lunch counters, you know, the Woolworths counters. Then they said, you can't refuse to serve blacks. This was the beginning of the whole thing, using the Commerce Clause, sending in federal troops to enforce the Constitution using the Commerce Clause. So anyhow, she in this case said, well, you know, we don't protect the bugs. In criminal law, she said that a guy who was flying out of the country and said that his luggage was unlawfully searched, that he had no right to claim that. That's not a big deal necessarily. In habeas corpus, she actually agreed that a fellow who's mentally retarded is entitled to a lawyer. So it looks like, you know, kind of a middle ground thing. In a damage award, she reduced damages to a fellow whose wife and daughter were killed in a car crash from $1 million down to $200,000. We'll see. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, here's an interesting development. In fact, I would say a fascinating development. The Wall Street Journal is reporting on their electronic homepage, on their front page, that it's probably going to be Edith Brown Clement, and that in 2001, in a questionnaire, I'm telling you, this is Tony Perkins tonight is going to be beside himself if it's Edith Brown Clement. In a questionnaire in 2001, Judge Edith Brown Clement said, "The Supreme Court has clearly held that the right to privacy guaranteed by the Constitution includes the right to have an abortion, and the law is settled in that regard." Ho ho ho! Yeah. She was nominated for the Fifth Circuit by George Bush's father, George H.W. Bush. She served until 2001 before being nominated by President George W. Bush to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Passed the Senate 99-0 vote. In the business arena, Judge Clement is considered a conservative, business-friendly, and law-and-order jurist. As it notes the Wall Street Journal, in broader legal circles, she is known as a strict constructionist. In 2002, she dissented from an opinion upholding an armed robbery conviction under the Federal Hobbs Act. She and her fellow dissenters concluded that because the crimes affected local stores in Fort Worth, Texas, they lacked enough relation to interstate commerce to trigger federal jurisdiction. Very interesting. Well, this is going to present quite a conundrum. It looks to me like this is the kind of candidate that the Wall Street Journal would want, that the business community would want, and not the kind of candidate that the Tony Perkinses of the world would want, and thus guaranteed to produce some serious hysteria from the right wing tonight. So we'll see. If it's Edith Brown Clement, you know, we'll see. She's born in 1948 in Birmingham, Alabama, a Southern girl, 57 years old. You got her bachelor's degree from the University of Alabama in 1969, her law degree from Tulane in 1972. But I'm telling you, this statement, this is the first time I've seen this anywhere. We've been surfing all around the web. Somebody at the Wall Street Journal dug this thing up, and they just put it on their website. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. But it's not the only thing in the news. And something on your mind, 1-866, our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. Alan in a lot of South Carolina on the line. Hey, Alan, what's up?
I heard that they're voting today, I think today, about this fuel surcharge for truckers.
I didn't know about that. Tell me about it.
It's part of the highway bill, and it's where truckers are supposed to get the money back for the fuel. They pass it on to the corporations.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And it sounds like the big corporations are trying to keep that from happening.
That makes sense.
So it'd be a good idea to vote, call your senator today and vote, make sure that stays in the highway bill.
Okay. Probably if you simply called your senator at 1-877-SOB-USOB and called both your senators, actually, and said, please support our truckers when you're looking at the highway bill. Would that be a good way to say it? They'd know what you were talking about?
Yeah, the independent truckers.
The independent truckers. Please support the independent truckers when you're looking at the highway bill today.
Yeah, and keep the surcharge in the highway bill.
Keep the surcharge in the highway bill.
Yes.
Okay. Well, good to know that, Alan. Thank you for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. This is, you know, you're welcome. Citizen activism at its best. I mean, that's it. And I'm pleased to be an instrument for it. Because that's what we all have to be. We all have to become citizen activists if we want to try and turn this ship of state around from the bizarre and wrong-headed direction it's been going. Edith Brown Clement, will she be the next Supreme Court justice? Increasingly looking like it. What kind of judge will she be? Good question. Truth be told, Justice O'Connor was pretty pro-business. The business community liked her a lot. So, we'll see. 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Became suspect and bending low as if to hear.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour. Changing the subject tonight at 9 o'clock. Notes Faiz over on the thinkprogress.org blog. As one Republican strategist has noted, this from the Associated Press, a Republican strategist with close ties to the White House said Bush could announce his pick as early as Tuesday. The strategist said the timing of an announcement had been moved up in part to deflect attention away from a CIA leak controversy that has engulfed Bush's top political adviser, Karl Rove. The strategist said of the Supreme Court decision, it will happen any day, adding that the aim is to change the subject from Rove. Well, it looks like they have succeeded in doing that. This is an administration that does a very, very good job of trashing people who tell the truth and rewarding people who lie. It just very, very simply boils down to that in a very, very real way. The Center for American Progress did a marvelous job of summarizing some of this, pointing out, for example, this isn't just about Valerie Plame. This isn't just about Joe Wilson. This isn't just about, you know, one family, one guy who pointed out that Bush was lying us into a war and therefore had to be taken out. Like, you know, some mafia don, he's getting in our way, put a dead horse's head in his bed. Go after his wife. I mean, did you get that? Remember Chris Matthews saying that Karl Rove called him while he was on the air during a commercial break and said, while he was interviewing Joe Wilson, and said, Joe Wilson's wife is fair game? I mean, why hasn't Chris Matthews been brought before a federal grand jury? I'm scratching my head on that one. But anyhow, as Margaret Carlson said, in the Bush administration, you lose your job not for lying, but for telling the truth. That's what you lose your job for. Or you get smashed and trashed if you tell the truth after you leave. For example, Richard Clark, counterterrorism director, or the Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill. Very, very simple. If you tell the truth in a way that doesn't make George Bush look like, you know, pure as the driven snow, you will be trashed. Eric Shinseki, for example. The Army's top general, chief of staff, number one guy, the number one guy in the Army, the top general. In 2003, in February, a month before the invasion of Iraq, Congress called him before Congress and said, okay, if we're going to invade Iraq, what's it going to take? What's going to happen? And Shinseki says it's going to take several hundred thousand troops to occupy the country after an invasion to maintain safety, quote, over a piece of geography that's fairly significant with the kinds of ethnic tensions that could lead to other problems, end quote. Now, Rummy, as he was inventing Rummy World, here he had Rummy making Rummy World and Wolfowitz, you know, let's make Rummy World. Let's turn Iraq into a neocon paradise. Let's change the Constitution, even though the International Convention at The Hague about, you know, war crimes and acts of war says you can't change the Constitution of a nation that you have invaded and occupied. Only a legitimately constituted government approved by the United Nations can change the constitution of its own country. But we did it anyway, in violation of international law and standards. And we changed the constitution of Iraq to say, for example, before we changed it, Iraq had the same law in place that, for example, China has, Japan has, most European countries have. Most countries have laws like this that say that if you're going to, if a multinational corporation is going to come into your country, or if an individual from a foreign country is going to come into your country and just start buying up companies, there's some oversight. The government has some oversight. They can set standards. They can say that that you must have a local partner. You can only own 49% of a company. You can't expatriate all the profits. You can't take all the profits out of the country and not have to pay any taxes on them. That you have to conform with local laws. That you have to follow certain policies. You have to follow local labor laws, things like that. You can't just bring in foreign workers. Even in the United States, we have a lot of these laws. Well, the neocons thought, you know, we're going to create a libertarian paradise over there. We're going to show the world that Ayn Rand was right. Alan Greenspan's right. Paul Wolfowitz is right. Ronald Reagan was right. George Bush was right. And that all the economists in history, rational, reasonable, normal economists in history, were wrong. From Desuet de Tracy back in 1785, right up to today. Right up to John Maynard Keynes. They're all wrong. We'll show you. Yeah, I know they brought the country out of the Great Depression. I know that they created the greatest peacetime prosperity in the history of the world. I know that they brought about the American middle class, but they were wrong. The right way to do it, slash taxes on the rich, raise taxes on the poor. You do that with a flat tax. So everybody pays the same. Whether you're a billionaire or whether you're struggling to make ends meet, everybody pays a flat 15%. They wrote that into the new Iraqi constitution. That a corporation can do anything it wants. No rules. For all practical purposes. They can take all the profit out of the country. They can come in and they can buy anything in the country, any business. Even if that business might be necessary for the survival of the defense of the country. For example, you could argue that there is a strong case to be made, even here in the United States, that a domestic steel industry is necessary. If you ever get into a war, you need to be able to make tanks, airplanes, a domestic aluminum industry, a domestic, you know, machine tool industry. But the cons have been saying since Ronald Reagan in the United States, and certainly Wolfie and Bush and Cheney and Rummy, that in Rummy world, Iraq, it's a new world. There's no such thing as an essential industry. Everything's for sale. Everything. This is why in April of 2001, 6 months before 9/11, Richard Cheney, Vice President of the United States, sat down at a meeting with Ken Lay and other representatives of the oil industry in the White House and pulled out a map of Iraq that showed nearly 100 oil fields and created a list titled Potential Suitors for Iraq's Oil, and made a list of countries on the left column, and then next to that, the next column over, companies within those countries, and then the next column over, for each company within each country, they designated one of the oil fields. Who's going to have this oil field, who's going to have that oil field, who's going to have this oil field, figured it all out, gave it all away. It's a conservative paradise. The people of Iraq, they don't have any say. We don't believe they, you know, the cons don't believe in representative democracy. They really don't. They believe in a corporate aristocracy. They seriously and legitimately think that that's the most stable form of governance. Turn everything over to the corporations. Let them run the water. Let them run the electricity. Let them run the, let them determine how dirty the air is going to be. Let them determine how pure the water is going to be. Let them determine whether or not the food is safe and pure. Because they say, if one of those corporations produces bad water or bad food, everybody will know about it and they won't patronize that corporation anymore. What they overlook is that, number one, some of these things are natural monopolies. And number two, that you have the reality that in a large community, you don't necessarily have the ability for word to travel. I mean, I lived in a little town in Vermont for many years, Montpelier, Vermont, 8,900 people. And I remember there was a doctor in town who was behaving poorly, shall we say. He moved into town from someplace else. I don't know where he came from. He moved into town, set up shop, and within a few months, everybody in town knew this guy was not the guy to go to. And I don't know if it took 4 months, 5 months, I'm not sure how long it took before the medical board got on him, and they suspended his license. But long before that, everybody in town knew, don't go to this guy. You know, he's no good, he's incompetent. Well, that's fine. In a little town of 8,900 people. But what happens when he moves to New York City? Or Boston? Or Cleveland? Or Chicago? Or Pittsburgh? Or San Francisco? Or Seattle? And there's just a steady, you know, you don't have a small local community. And he doesn't get outed. Well, then it's important to have something to protect us from the predators. And you can't have the predators protect us from the predators. I'm sorry. It just, you know, doesn't work. Can't have the predators protect us from the predators. But that's what the Bushies set up. So they changed the Constitution of Iraq to allow the predators to protect the Iraqis from the predators. And the Iraqis are saying, no, we don't like it. We don't like the fact that we have 50% unemployment and you're importing people from the Philippines to work here. We don't think that's right. I mean, you've got our own GIs saying they don't like the fact that the second largest army in Iraq is private contractors who are being paid $150,000 each. Although the Army just now hit its recruiting goals for the first time, it's also the first time that we've offered $150,000 signing bonuses. Might that have something to do with it? Anyhow, Shinseki goes before Congress, and he says it's going to take several hundred thousand troops to occupy post-war Iraq. And Wolfie, good old Wolfie, who's now president of the World Bank, spreading his libertarian philosophy far and wide and destroying more of the world than he could as undersecretary State or Defense, wherever he was. Wolfie comes before the Congress and says, oh, no, that's wildly off the mark. That's a direct quote. Wildly off the mark. Attacking Shinseki. Rumsfeld then goes to Army Secretary Tom White. You know, you remember the former vice president of Enron, the guy who's in charge of the Army, the George Bush put in charge of the Army. Yes, the former vice president of Enron. And Rumsfeld goes to him and says, you got to rebuke Shinseki. How dare he say that? Tom White says, no, I'm not going to do it. So Rumsfeld fires White. And Shinseki. And not one single one of Rumsfeld's top aides attended Shinseki's retirement ceremony. And guess who was right? Shinseki. Not Bush. Not Rummy. Because Rummy World Now is a disaster. Rummy World Now is one of the most dangerous places on earth for an American soldier to show up. Smeared for telling the truth, Army General Eric Shinseki. One of many. Tell the truth in the Bush administration, you are toast. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. Tom in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, aren't you, Tom?
Yeah.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, this on this Rummy World. I emailed you yesterday regarding a thing on Lou Dobbs tonight. He had a libertarian guy from the Cato Institute.
Yesterday.
Did you get that?
I did.
Okay. Basically, what you're talking about dovetails right into this. This shows what I've always been saying, that these guys, these conservatives, will not accept that democracy...
These so-called conservatives.
Okay, right. The libertarians, the so-called neocons, that political democracy, they will not accept that that is superior to economic capitalism. They just will not accept that, right? And Lou Dobbs gets this guy on, and they were talking about the oil that China, communist, autocratic communist China, was trying to buy Unocal. And I'm looking here at the transcript, and he says, the guy, the Cato guy, says, well, but my point is the world oil markets in such a way that as long as oil is produced, it doesn't affect who owns it or where it goes. It's one giant global market. And Lou Dobbs says, well, there's one fallacy in that view, and the only problem is that you're saying what you're saying about free markets. Free markets are supposed to be assured by democracy.
Yeah, Tom, I can't have you reading a transcript from the Lou Dobbs show on the radio. I'm sorry.
Okay, basically he says, this Cato guy says, well, France is more communistic than China is.
Yeah,
and then Lou Dobbs says, say what? See, these guys don't recognize that democracy is superior to capitalism.
No, they don't. They don't understand what democracy is. That's the bottom line, Tom. And the reason why the libertarians don't understand what democracy is because Ayn Rand didn't understand what democracy is.
And most conservatives don't understand what communism is and socialism and on and on and on. They mix, like you always say, the political with the economic. It's all blur to them.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, that's where we as Democrats and liberals have to define genuine democracy.
Yeah. Well said.
Yep.
I agree with you. Thank you, Tom, for the call. And in fact, that's where, and I'm telling you, this is what one of the big problems that is happening in Iraq right now, one of the major problems that Iraq is having, has to do with the fact that we have gone in, changed their constitution, and created this neocon economic paradise that is just absolutely not working. We've created an absolute disaster in Iraq by changing their laws, changing their tax structure, outlawing unions, and you've got all these folks who are saying, hey, what happened to our businesses? What happened to our companies? What happened to our domestic industries? They're gone. They're wiped out. And surprise, you have an insurgency. Hey, it's Randy. Hey, Randy. And it's like, what are you going to expect? If you go into a country and you rip apart their social fabric and you rip apart their economic structure and you say, oh, we're going to replace it with this wonderful Rummy World, neocon paradise where any company can do anything they want, but you can't have a labor union. And you think people aren't going to be a little upset about that? You think there's not going to be blowback from that? And then Tom Tancredo goes on the air and says, well, let's just drop a nuclear bomb on Mecca. These guys are just like, they are so in outer space. I hate to quote Chuck Hagel, but they really are making it up as they go along. And they are clueless. Everything George Bush has touched in his presidency so far has just absolutely disintegrated. It's been a disaster. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
People get ready. There's a train coming. You don't need no package. You just feed on it all.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. We're going to see tonight. We're going to find out. We will hear. We will know. We will get a sense of. We will finally discover who George W. Bush is going to nominate for Supreme Court Justice. Is it going to be Edith Jones, the fairly heavy-duty hardcore right-winger, or is it going to be Edith Brown Clements, who actually apparently has said that she thinks that the Constitution should protect a right to abortion, but in a case involving Walmart property, Judge Clements has said Walmart's rights supersede those of endangered species. Interesting, eh? I've been pointing out to you on this program now for weeks how the Wall Street Journal has been subtly, but in ways that I guarantee you are very carefully read in the corridors of power in Washington, D.C., subtly but openly lobbying for a Supreme Court justice who will operate to the benefit of multinational corporations and large business interests and inherited wealth in the United States, even if that means that it's a person who is not going to rule against abortion rights. In fact, the Wall Street Journal has pointed out fairly openly that justices like Scalia and Thomas, who would vote, who would rule against abortion rights, do so on the basis of what they call the states' rights argument, suggesting that the ability to determine whether or not abortion should be legal is something that should be a decision that should be made by the local legislature, by a state legislature. And the business community doesn't like that. They like one-stop shopping for their bribes. If they're going to bribe somebody in business, they want to simply have to do it on K Street in Washington, D.C. Send one lobbyist over to one senator's office with one big check, and that's the end of it. They don't like having to go to all 50 states and apply, you know, and lobby 50 different legislatures and deal with newspapers in 50 different states. They want a business-friendly judge. And it looks like in Judge Edith Clements, they will have one. And if so, this is simply, you know, the multimillionaire George W. Bush, born with a multimillion-dollar trust fund, acknowledging his birth, acknowledging his class, his social station, and those people who put him into business. He says, some people call you the haves and the have-mores. I call you my base. If he nominates Clements, we will know that he has absolutely acknowledged that unambiguously. We'll find out tonight. 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Until then, we'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.